My name's Jim Stone. I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. Thanks, Dirk, for asking me to speak. I've really enjoyed this weekend. I've had a lot of fun, a lot of quiet time. Got to do a little bit of AA work on the side. And my sobriety date is July the 22nd, 1992. And I came into the fellowship group in Huntsville, Alabama. My current home group is the Three Legacies group. My very first sponsor was named Bob. Bob's in a hospital in a nursing home now, slowly fading away. But he's been slowly fading away ever since I've gotten sober, so that's been 25 years. So how long are you going to hang on to that nursing center, I don't know. He's outlived all the doctor's prognosis, I'll put it that way. But Bob said something to this effect: if you want what I have, you'll do what I did to get it. And I was thrust into service work right off the get-go. And this is how that happened. We had a business. He says, you will attend. He did not suggest. He says, you will attend business meetings. And at that time, the fellowship group still is a huge group, but it was a really huge group back in those days, 350 members. And you go to the business meeting, there'd be 80 people at the business meeting. And they were factions. I kid you not. And I mean, there used to be this saying, you know, I went to a fight and a business meeting broke out. You know, that's about how it was. They were very contentious. And matter of fact, the guy that was Bob was not my first sponsor. My first sponsor was my temporary sponsor. I had him for about 90 days. And heck, he called his sponsor out, who was Victor, and was going to whoop him in the parking lot, you know, over something that was going on in a business meeting. So it was really, business meetings were interesting. I'll put it that way. And so especially interesting to people who kind of thrived on conflict, as long as I wasn't the victim, you know. But Bob says, you'll go to business meetings. And I went to the business meeting, and it got to the very end of the business meeting. They asked for volunteers to be janitor. And of course, you know, I was telling Randy, I was in the Navy. And Navy is an acronym. And it says never again volunteer yourself. That's exactly what that stands for. And so I wasn't going to volunteer for anything. But they got around and asked for janitors at the end of the business meeting, and Bob raised his hand. And I'm thinking, that's awful nice of Bob. The chairperson says, yes, Bob. And Bob says, Jim will do it. You know, and that's how I got into service work. And I'm grateful that it happened that way. I wish we'd do it a lot more. I grew up in Athens, Alabama. Actually, let me rephrase that. There's a little community outside northwest of Athens, Alabama called Shanghai. And that's where I grew up. And it is just, there's a little Baptist church, Shanghai Baptist Church there. And that was the community I grew up in. My family was poor. And I'd say on a financial scale, we were probably upper, lower class or whatever. My dad he was a plumber and electrician for the County Board of Education. And we farmed on the side. You know, I can remember as a kid looking at, didn't have air conditioner until, I don't think we had an air conditioner until I went away to the Navy and they got an air conditioner after I left. That's rough in the summer in North Alabama not to have an air conditioner. And I can remember looking out the back window of the house. We had 63 acres, and my dad would be out there at midnight plowing by the headlights of an 8N Ford. That's a rough way to make a living. And we had 5 kids. And I think 4 of those kids we had without health insurance. We had to pay for all that stuff. And so, looking back though, we never lacked really anything. We had clothes on our back. We had good food. We had chickens and pigs and all that stuff. Had a garden. I mean, all the stuff that country folk have back in those days. And yet from my earliest memories, all I wanted to do was be somewhere else. And earliest as the fourth grade, I can I can remember my fourth grade teacher saying something to the effect, if you are a daydreamer, you have mental illness. And I'm going, God, I am crazy as hell. Because I was always a daydreamer, and I always wanted to be somewhere else, you know. And it was not that I was unintelligent, but I had this people-pleasing thing, and I wanted to be better. I always wanted shortcuts. I didn't want to really work for what I had. And I had that from my early age. And I also had this curiosity about alcohol. And I don't really know where that was come from, whether it was ingrained in me, you know, from DNA or whatever, you know. But I can remember looking at magazine ads. You know, there was old Forrester, old Granddad, or whatever, the magazines in the magazines, you know, and they'd have a picture of the bottle and the people would be rock climbing. And I'm thinking today, you know, today I go, yeah, I could see rock climbing, drinking old Granddad, you know. You'd probably be on the rocks down below going, eee, what a good time, you know. So anyway, but there wasn't any alcohol in the house. But, you know, like I say, I went to school, and I cheated all the way through high school. And what, like I say, it wasn't because I was unintelligent. I think I was just really wanting attention, and I eventually got it. When I got out of high school, I wanted to join the Navy. My dad says, he says, you can join the Navy if you want to, but I suggest you go at least 1 year of college and see, you know, because he'd been in World War II. He knew about the military. Vietnam was going on at that time. He wasn't anti-war per se, but he knew what war was. You know, I mean, it's not a glamorous thing. Horrible, to be honest with you. So he says, go to school for a year, then if you want to join the Navy, you can do that. So I went to school, and amazingly, I made good grades. And I didn't cheat. I never cheated after high school. From alcohol, perspective of alcohol, my first taste of alcohol, I was 4 years old, and my uncle gave me a taste of beer, and it was Slitz. The next time I had a taste of any kind of alcoholic beverage, I was probably about 14, 15, maybe even 16 years old, when we were skinny dipping in this creek. Here come a family, whole family of, you know, people. We were out there skinny dipping, which was kind of embarrassing. But somebody had lost a ring. I guess that's what you call it, the six-pack ring, you know, with six beers on it. And there were five beers left on this ring, and it was Slitz. And I took a sip of it, and I said, tasted just like it did when I was 4 years old. I said, God, that's horrible. I don't know how people can even drink this stuff. So, you know, I didn't do much drinking. You know, maybe in the high school we would go. I lived in Limestone County. Athens is in Limestone County. It's a dry county. They had a law back in those days. I may even have it up here. EPL, violation of probation law. Prohibition law, I guess it was. If you were in a dry county and you got caught with beer, that's what you got charged with. And so you had to be careful. But we'd ride over to the Madison County line. And the thing was, the Limestone County deputies, they'd be on the other side of the line just waiting for you to come back across. You know, then they would arrest you. With EPL, and watch you buy it and then arrest you, you know. So you had to be careful. So we went over, we would get whatever, Coke, malt liquor, whatever, you know. I'd take a sip or two, but I never did get drunk. But after a year of college, I decided I would join the Navy, and I did. The weekend before I was going to go into the Navy, I thought maybe it was time to get drunk. I don't really know where that thought really come from, but I mean, it was kind of like rites of passage, you know, let's get drunk, you know, before I leave home. So we go to the county line, me and a guy named George and another guy named Alan. George at one time was a judge, and Alan still is a county deputy. So we would go over to the county line, buy a six pack. They drank two, and I drank four, and I ain't drunk. I want to go back and get some more. And because they were afraid, you know, hell, we were all under 21. And they were, Alan was a year younger, and I think George was a couple of years younger than I was. So they were afraid to go back. And George, who became the judge in his infinite wisdom, tossed a bottle of Listerine over the back of the seat and says, "If you want to get drunk, drink this." So my first drunk was on Slits and Listerine. I'd flinch too. I still flinch when I think of Listerine. I won't even gargle with that stuff, you know. And you talk about getting sick. God almighty, I was sick. Lost my shoes in a blackout. And, you know, and I get to AA many years later. This was in 1969. I get to AA in 1992. And I finally read, you know, page 30, I believe, is more about alcoholism. And it says, you know, something, every alcoholic has something to the effect that every alcoholic has the delusion that they can drink like normal people. I had more than one delusion when I walked in here, by the way. But I had that delusion I could drink like normal people. Now, I have never drank like a normal person. I don't think would drink. You know, I may have done it a few times, but there was always the big bang waiting. You know, and time went along. I better keep my eye on the watch. I'll be dragging a big, long, hour-long drunk along here if I'm not careful. But anyway, time goes along, and I eventually end up being sent to Guam. And in Guam, I was introduced to drugs. And I spent 6 years in the Navy. And by the time I got out of the Navy, I didn't know it. But by the time I got out of the Navy, I was an addict. I didn't know that. And when I came back home, you know, drugs were available, and I smoked a lot of pot. I won't lie to you. But alcohol was the go-to. And so I started drinking on a daily basis. Another thing that happened on Guam is when I went to Guam, I actually went to submarine school too, Groton, Connecticut. And one of the instructors at the submarine school says, you know, let's see, Brent, glad you're here. So he says, you go to Guam, he says, there's a woman behind every pine tree. He says, unfortunately, there is not a pine tree on the island. Well, he lied. There was one. And I'd say I fell in love, but that's really not the appropriate definition. You know, what happened, I fell in sick. That's really what the definition of that was, or explanation of that was. And I ended up asking that gal to marry me. And she said yes. Now, I didn't. The only thing we had in common was LSD. That was it, you know. And now, as soon as she got out of sight, she changed her mind, you know, and so I never did marry the girl. But, you know, I'm a typical alcoholic, so I go into about a 20-year tailspin over that. And deep in the dumps, you know, oh, woe is me, self-pity, and I get back home, and I start trying to drink myself to death. It was slowly. I mean, you know, I started out, you know, with maybe two or three beers a day, six packs a day, but I was a daily drinker. I mean, I drank every day for roughly 17 years. I got to the point by 1986, I got out of the Navy in 1975. By 1986, I was chemically impaired every waking minute if I could sleep. And primarily based at night on alcohol. I was, you know, get off work and I'd start drinking alcohol, but I'd smoke a joint on the way to work, and I'd smoke a joint at lunch, and I'd smoke a joint on the way home. You know, and I'm going to tell you something. When I got into AA, I had every intention of quitting drinking and not quitting smoking dope. And my sponsor says, Jim, he says, my experience is you get awful thirsty when you smoke dope. And you know what? I went, no, I do. You know? But that wasn't what made me quit smoking dope. But what happened is after years of drinking, well, there are a few things that happened. I'll finish out the drunk log and I'll get to that. You know, my drinking did change. You know, I got drunk one time, and I ended up being stationed in a place called Damn Neck, Virginia, which is 2 miles south of Virginia Beach, and it's really a great place to be stationed. Virginia Beach is a good place to be stationed, I'm going to tell you about that. But I remember drinking some Southern Comfort, and there was only one guy I knew from Athens, Alabama, and I declared war on him. Now, I did this in a blackout, and I mean, why this guy didn't just beat the crap out of me, I don't know. I'm in a blackout, you know. I mean, what could I really have done, you know? How much damage could I have done, you know? But what happened was, is I go into a blackout, and I declare war on this guy, and it was the night of the first college football game, Alabama and Ole Miss. And that was when Archie Manning was playing, and I think Alabama won by 1 point. I missed the whole game. Didn't even know what had happened until the next day. You know, and I'm a huge Alabama fan. But anyway, I shouldn't have said that in Tennessee. Somebody might shoot me. But anyway, what happened was, is I blackout in the end. I blackout. I get sick. I'm on the toilet. And I fall off the toilet. I throw up right on the floor, right in front of the toilet. This is by the graphic, by the way. And head first right into my barf. And somebody took pictures of me just to let me know what I had done. And I had a big puddle of barf right here, you know. You know, that did not slow me down a bit. I mean, it was like, I said, oh, that's me on the floor. You know, I'm kind of proud of this stuff. I'm just sick in the head. I really was. Didn't know what life was about. And so things like that would happen. Get out of the Navy. I never drank Southern Comfort again. Never drank Listerine again. You know, I will change. You know, if it hurts, bat it up. But I got out of the Navy. We went to a party in Bunnertown, Tennessee, which is right across the state line, right up close to Minor Hill, if everybody knows where Minor Hill is. We go to Minor Hill, get some beers. None of the beer joints up there unless you go to a bootlegger. And then went to Tennessee and got some tequila. Now, folks, tequila was my drug of choice. As old Bill Anderson from Cullman used to say, you know, tequila was his drug of choice too. And he says the only problem with tequila was consequences. You know, and that was my experience with tequila was consequences, you know. That was the first night I ever drank moonshine. And the last thing I remember of that night was a fruit jar of moonshine right here. And I go into the blackout. I wake up the next morning. In a car, my car, somebody else is driving it. And they'd already took me to my house, couldn't get me out of the car, and they were going back, they done gave up and was going back home with me right along in the car. And so when I come to, this is what alcoholics just love, this phrase, do you remember what you did last night? Yeah, God, do we hate that phrase. And I go, no. And he says, well, you took a piss in Bunny's refrigerator last night. And you talking about, now, oh, no kidding. You talking about, I didn't even know what amends was, you know. But I go back up to, she was the bartender at one of the bars at Minor Hill, and I go back and I apologize to her, you know. I mean, I felt about that low, you know. And my friend says, well, they would have killed you if they hadn't have been laughing. So my drinking, so I became off hard liquor. No more hard liquor. I can't handle it. No more tequila. You know, I'm just going to drink beer. And beer like to kill me. And now professionally, I started out at the bottom of the pole, computer maintenance, and then progressed through my professional career and eventually ended up being a manager of the whole operation, which was, well, you're talking about ego trip. I was manager of computer maintenance for NASA testing. So, I mean, rocket engine firings, and we took all the data and all that good stuff. Man, that was an ego trip. And I don't think I was a very good manager, but boy, I sucked up that ego stuff. And but drinking every day. And I ended up working for a large company, and they did a company survey. And it would go off to headquarters in Washington, Seattle, Washington, and then float all the way back down and come back to the troops in a PowerPoint presentation. Anybody knows what a PowerPoint presentation is? And I can still remember my bullet on a PowerPoint presentation. And my bullet was this: my supervisor smells like yesterday's beer. And I knew who they were talking about. Exactly who they were talking about. And all of these things, all these instances that are happening are like straws on the camel back. And eventually, the camel breaks down. And the camel was Jim. You know? And the last major thing that happened that really broke the camel's back was in 1989. I got caught in a tornado on Airport Road in Huntsville, Alabama. Dead center of an F-4 tornado. And obviously didn't get killed, but there were 24 people got killed in that tornado. Hundreds hurt. Probably thousands minorly hurt. Right in rush hour, right down a main street. And blew the top floor off my apartment building. And I had gone to the beer store, got a beer, 12-pack of beer. I don't know why I needed another 12-pack of beer. I probably have a case and a half in the refrigerator right here ready, just in case somebody come over. You know, you got to be prepared. You know, and by this time, nobody's coming over, especially during the week. And I'm a solitary drinker. You know, I drink all alone. Poor old pitiful kid. But anyway, I'm sitting there and I have two beers before the fire department comes in and runs me out. But before they come and run me out, there was a gal on the street. I never even saw her. I wouldn't even go out and look. One of my fears, it's always been a fear of mine, is blood, gore, and guts. I'm not one of the kinds that drive by an automobile wreck and stop and go gawk at the wreck. That's just not going to happen. Now, I might go over and try to help if I'm the first person there or something, but I'm not going over there just to see blood, gore, and guts. I'll tell you that right now. I'll avoid it if I have to. And I'm sitting in my living room, what's left of my apartment. All the windows are blown out, and drinking my beer, and this woman is screaming, "Please help me out in the street." And I don't know who that woman lived or died, but I wouldn't go out there. And I never had another drink or another good drunk or another happy drunk after that. I got drunk plenty of times. I got drunk every day. But it was just, from before that, I would have told you I was just a nice guy that maybe drank too much. But after that, I felt like a piece of crap. And I started getting in more and more trouble at work. You know, I told you about the survey. Well, my boss, I did not know. I was also a naive human being. I didn't know that as much alcohol and much beer I was drinking, my body wouldn't absorb it, and I began to sweat beer right out my pores. And I thought it was my breath. You know, maybe they smelt my breath from the night before. And so that, I began to be called on the carpet about the way I smelled. You know, and so some, I don't even know what year it was, maybe 1989, late 1989, 1990, I got called on the carpet, and I quit for 3 months. You know, well, actually, that was 1986. I got kicked out of my apartment in 1986. A girl came into my life, and she really helped me, really the reason I got sober, to be honest with you. But she just wanted my dope, wanted a friend, and of course, here's Jim, fell in sick again. You know, don't even know what love, not a clue what love even is. And I don't find that out until I get to the wounds of alcoholism. But we really did become friends. And I became embarrassed of how I drank in 1986. But right shortly after that, she had another boyfriend, and I'm back to drinking again. But I'm not going to drink like I used to drink. I'm not going to drink the blackout every night. You know, I'm going to just control my drink. So I only drank 10, 11, 12 beers a day. That's controlled drinking. You know, rationalization, you know, the insanity of that state. And then for that 6 years, you know, for three more years, I drank like that. I get called on the carpet and work. I quit for 3 weeks. After 3 weeks, I'm thinking, you know, maybe if I use some Tic Tac, that'd solve this problem. Eat some breakfast. Brush my teeth. I was not a very hygienic person at this stage. I got kicked out of the apartment I was living in. And anybody here seen the movie Days of Wine and Roses? There's a scene in there where they spray the gal's apartment for roaches. And everybody in the whole apartment complex is complaining about all the roaches in their apartment, because what happened is the roaches would leave her apartment and go to everybody else's apartment. But I had a 30-gallon trash can with no liner in it, and it'd be overflowing at the top with beer cans. And I'm going to tell you right now, roaches love beer. I mean, just drive them. You could set a beer, and this is gross, but you could set a beer on my, you could set a beer on my coffee table, and you were very, you know, you might have to flick a roach off the top of the beer can to take a drink. It was that bad. Oh, seriously. So they kicked me out of that apartment, obviously. And I'm a good drunk, so I moved back in with the parents. And so, you know, and I end up meeting a girl and become embarrassed about how I'm drinking. Quit for the 3 months. Get called on the carpet a couple of years, 2 or 3 years later, and start back drinking again. And get called on the carpet again about a year before I quit drinking. I quit for a week that time. And then notice the periods are getting shorter between me stopping and starting, by the way. And in 1992, or maybe it was October of 91, actually, I came across a couple of tickets to go see Chet Atkins at the Von Braun. It wasn't the main, it was the off to the side, I can't remember what it's called. But anyway, and I had two tickets, and the person I was going to go with backed out, so I called over to Ashley. It was this girl that I was talking about, her brother-in-law. And he was a guitar picker, so I was going to give him the tickets. And she answers the phone. And I said, well, you know, I got a couple of tickets to see Chet Atkins. Would you want to go? She said, sure, I'd love to. So I go over there, and once again, what had happened was she had broke up with her boyfriend, and she was seeing me piss off her boyfriend. That's exactly what she was doing. And I didn't know that. And so I get suckered into this, you know, crap again. But as I'm, after this happens, I'm sitting in my TV chair drinking a beer going, Jim, quit drinking once over this girl. Maybe that was the whole idea. Maybe that was God's plan for you, is to quit drinking. Maybe that was his whole deal. And I begin thinking this stuff. And it took me another 6 months to get up the courage to quit drinking. You know, called on the carpet once again, you know. And so in July the 13th, 1992, I called my employee assistance program, which I'm grateful we had one. They referred me to an outpatient treatment center. And I've never had a drink since July 13th, 1992. That's not my sobriety. My first AA meeting was July the 18th, 1992. Went to the fellowship group. And now, I was following, by this time, I was miserable. And I hope you're miserable. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to say that somebody, you wish somebody to be miserable. But people don't get to Alcoholics Anonymous because it's the days of wine and roses. Well, maybe it is if you take it to the length of the movie. But we usually get to AA because we are miserable, or somebody's on our back. We got back problems. Or the judge is on our back, or boss is on our back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but not because we have an alcohol problem. And now, I knew deep down in the bottom of my heart, I knew I was an alcoholic. The trouble is, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. You know, matter of fact, I come into the room just like it says on page 30, with the idea that somehow, someday, I might be able to drink like a normal person. I think that right there almost describes an alcoholic right there, you know. Another thing I think that it's not in the big book, but it surely happened to me is if you're sitting in your TV chair wondering if you have a drinking problem, you have probably got a drinking problem. Normal people don't think that. I mean, it don't cross their mind. Well, they didn't, because they ain't got a drinking problem, you know. But I had a drinking problem. And more than that, I was alcoholic. Like, you know, there are people who have alcohol problems that may not be alcoholic. You know, maybe they are heavy drinkers out there, but I was a heavy drinker, but I believe I'm an alcoholic. And so I get referred to, I get to the treatment center, go to fellowship group, and I'm going to tell you right now, I loved the camaraderie, the laughter, the joy that appeared to be in that room. It was very attractive. You know, one of the traditions is attraction rather than promotion. And you know what? That was very attractive to me, that laughter and joy. And I was so impressed with AA. After that meeting, I went over to this girl's house and her brother-in-law's and her brother and her sister. And I tried to convince, smoked up with them and tried to convince them to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a saying in treatment centers, you got to change old playmates and old playgrounds. I just described how you do that. Just invite them to Alcoholics Anonymous and you won't have to worry about seeing them again, you know, because they're going to disappear just like those cockroaches when you turn on the lights, you know. Yeah. And that's about the truth. And so that began my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there have been ups and downs in sobriety. My journey through the steps. I go through the steps with my sponsor, and really it was like an initiation rite. I'm just following suggestions. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I don't think maybe even that the steps work. You know, and most certainly, you know, they were telling me, my first sponsor, before I got Bob as my permanent sponsor, and, you know, my first sponsor was telling me to pray, and I'm thinking, why? Because, you see, I'm one of these guys that was a scoffer. I just didn't believe that worked. You know, and yet my experience has been, yes, it does work. You know, the only scoffers at prayer is the only ones who have not tried it enough. I think it says something about that in the 12 and 12. You know, and so I come in, I begin to trudge through the steps the first time, and I get through a few amends, and I don't make a bunch of them, you know. And I'm involved in service work. I'm doing Grapevine at the group. I did literature at the group, probably CPC at the group. Got on two roundup committees, the Riverside Roundup and the Hospital Roundup, got on those committees doing that kind of work, and I was really having a good time. And, you know, these roundups, well, they're not necessarily officially a function of Alcoholics Anonymous, but alcoholic members put them in here. But some people may disagree with this statement, but really the idea of these things is to show people who are newcomers that there's life after alcohol. And you know what? There is life. There's a good life after alcohol. And so you come in here and you start having fun. Now I'll tell you something else about it. When you get back home, if you're new from this roundup, I would find myself an AA meeting and get to it right away. Because you're probably going to have an emotional letdown when you leave here. Because you're having a good time, and then now you're going to walk right back out into the real world, and here's all the crap that's been going on right behind you. So you need to get to a meeting and start this journey into real Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's where the solution to our problem is. And that's not going to be a short-term deal. For Jim, it was years of doing this. Now, I enjoyed it, and I developed a lot of friends in here. But I put off working those steps in reality. Like I said, there was amends I didn't make. So as and and I And I picked up an arrogance in sobriety or sobriety or whatever you want to call it, where people would say something like this, and it was really a good idea. My sponsor has me pick up the big book every morning and read pages 84 through 88 and do everything it says on those pages every day. Jim is thinking, you may have to do it, but I don't. I'll tell you from personal experience, that is a recipe for disaster. Because what happened to Jim was, at 4 years sober, or 4 years not drinking, I hit bottom. And I mean, it was just about as bad as when I quit drinking. Except now, I don't want to drink, and I'm absolutely miserable, and I'm driven to my knees in my living room, going, God, please help me, and man, I meant every word. I could not think of a more serious prayer to say than, God, please help me. And I did that, got up, started reading the big book, and doing what the big book said to me. And during this time, I had already started sponsoring people. Sponsorship is a blessing. I mean, newcomers don't want to do it, and I can understand. Because you see, I'm afraid. I'm a fear-based human being. I'm afraid of admitting to God myself into another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. I don't want to work with another alcoholic because I'm a loner. I most certainly don't want to go to all the people that I have harmed and make amends for what I have done wrong. And that is not an apology. That's asking somebody, what can I do to make it right? And then shut up and listen. And do what they asked you to do. Now, have I done that? The only person that ever did that to me was my youngest sister. The rest of them said, that's good, just quit drinking, Jim. That's all we want you to do. But my youngest sister said, Jim, I want you to go back to the church. And I haven't been back. Rightly, wrongly, or indifferent. But you know what? And I was telling Dirk this too. My youngest nephew, when he graduated from high school, he was given a lot of money for graduation. And unfortunately, he spent it on cocaine and alcohol. And ended up in rehab. Decided he would quit cocaine, but he wasn't going to quit drinking. Got a DUI. So I took him to a meeting at Fellowship Group, and Dirk was speaking. Dirk's talk didn't touch a brain cell on the way through. You know. And but a good talk for somebody who's brand spanking new to hear, come and tell you right now. You know, that will get your attention. And but anyway, he ended up all of my nephews ended up going to Auburn, two of them graduated from Auburn. He got to the last semester that he was going to. Dropped out, started tending bar. And he still works down there at a restaurant. Me and Dirk and several of us went to the restaurant down there and saw him working down there. And you know, whether he drinks or not is really none of my business. I have two brothers. Well, there, I didn't tell you about my family. I had two brothers, two sisters. None of the girls ever drank. I hope they never take a drink. But I think it runs in our family somehow. I don't know. But the three boys, there was myself included. My oldest brother, who is 6 years younger than I am, got sober 2 years before I did. Never talked about AA. We would go over to his apartment and get drunk. And we were proud of being the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's exactly what we thought, you know. I mean, and we'd tease him about it. You know, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And no thought of his sobriety or welfare whatsoever. But he never talked about AA. And finally, when I get to AA, I called him up. Well, actually, when I was going to treatment, I told him to go to treatment. And before the end, I had all this problems with me smelling like beer. I decided I'd start drinking vodka. Smart move, I'm going to tell you right now. And we are an intelligent sort. But I called my brother up, told him I was going to treatment. And the only words he said was, I knew that vodka would do it. That was all he said. You know, what more could be said? You know? So anyway, after the debacle where I hit bottom at 4 years sober, you know, I continued to work the steps. And 1994, actually, this is where I hit bottom. I had got laid off from this job that I had at that time for 19 years. And as I said, I was a manager, and it was really a blow to my ego. It really did. And I'm going to say this, for those who don't believe prayer works, I didn't know this was a prayer, but it was. I worked for a contractor, and every 4, 5, 6 years, however it is, they renegotiate our contract, and whoever wins the contract comes in and takes over. And I hate that phase in, period, and the negotiation. I hate everything about it. Just do not like it. And when I was drinking, I would get very upset about it, you know. And so here I am sober, and we're going through this process again, and I'm asking, I'm going, God, please do something about this job. Now, I did not realize that was a prayer. Well, the contract, a new company comes in with the contract, and old Jim doesn't get picked up. God has answered my prayer. And Jim ain't happy about it. I'm going to say this. I'm going to throw this out there right now. You know, one of the most disturbing things that's ever happened to Jim in sobriety is Jim didn't get his way. You know, and then the second most, I think one of the most, another disturbing thing, I don't think most disturbing thing, is if you're in a meeting and somebody shares something and it disturbs you, that's probably because you just heard the truth. Because it's very disturbing. The truth is very disturbing to an ill alcoholic. You know, we just don't want to. Reality was not my friend. And the process of these steps is me being able to face reality. And but I got unemployed, back to that. I got unemployed. And my sponsor says, well, he says, they asked you if you had a degree. He says, now that you're unemployed, he says, you can always go back to school. So I said, okay. So I went to UAH and ended up majoring in computer science with a minor in math. Now, mind you, I cheated all the way through high school, and particularly math. So that did not make it easy. But you know what? I ended up graduating with honors because I applied myself and I did the work and continued to go to school and meetings. Man, for those who come in here and go to school, I'm going to get that grant and I'm going to go to school and study and you leave off AA, let me tell you what, that think sign, you ain't thinking positive. I'm going to tell you that right now. My thinker is broke. You know, and I fell in love in AA, by the way, probably more than once, but I fell in love with AA. It did not go the way I wanted it to go, and I'm going to UAH, taking a Shakespeare class, advanced Shakespeare class, and now that is not a good place to be when you're not in a good spot, and the bottom line is she went out and relapsed after a couple of years, and I went off the deep end emotionally. And I mean, people were taking bets on whether I was going to stay sober or not, to be honest with you. And they lost money, but they were betting. And but I skipped the final exam. I go to the teacher and tell him what's going on. I almost told him the truth. Probably didn't tell him the whole truth, but I almost told him the truth. And I told him enough truth to get slide by. I'll put it that way, you know. And so he lets me postpone my exam. And being a typical alcoholic and running with, you give me a inch of rope, man, I'll take that sucker a mile if you give it to me. A year later, I go back and take that exam and pass it. Or maybe he just gave me a passing grade to get me off his list. I don't know which one it was. But that's, you know, people, the moral of this story is, if you apply yourself and you're somewhat trying to some extent, People will cut you a lot of slack. But there comes a point in time when you need to quit taking advantage of people. We have to come in here and change our lives. You know, I've made some horrible, horrible, horrible mistakes in alcoholics, and I'm a sucker. I'll mention this about language. My language basically is horrible. When I was in the Navy, I had a warrant officer tell me one time, "Jim, you cuss worse than any sailor I've ever met." I don't think he was giving me a compliment, you know, but I would do it. And so I don't always do it. And sometimes I will, sometimes if I think I can use those words to get your attention, I might use them. Or if I'm not thinking at all, like yesterday morning at breakfast when I dropped a glass of water right at my feet, I might let go with one of them, you know. But I'm trying not to do that anymore. And I'm not always successful at that. But you know, where I'm going with the steps of 6 and 7, I did not get struck perfect because I got sober. I still have the same character defects that I had when I walked in the rooms of alcoholics, and I'm still to this day. And the only reason I do not act out on those character defects is pain. Because when you see, when I got hit bottom, and I started going back and reading through the book again, and I could not tell you how many times I have read the big book. Because the language does not change, the words does not change, but the longer I get sober, and if I'm trying to do this deal, my perspective on what's being said is totally different. Almost slipped up right there. It's totally different. And I got to the last sentence in step 6, and it's talking about if we have character defects we won't let go of. And anytime it says this, it's a prayer. We ask God to help us be willing to have these character defects removed. And by the time I got that, I read that, and I understood what it was saying, I understood this. Prayer works. If I start praying for the willingness to have my character defects removed, what's going to happen is my character defects are going to stop bugging me. You know, I don't care if they bug you, because I'm selfish and self-centered. Still to this day, I'm still selfish and self-centered. Hopefully not as much as I was, but I'm still selfish and self-centered. So I keep just trudging down the road, doing the best I can do. After a couple of years, I was so ate up with resentment over losing the job, I changed sponsors. I've changed sponsors. I'm on my fourth sponsor. And you know, I change sponsors if you need to change sponsors. I'll say that. Don't change it frivolously because they're trying to get you to work the steps. But if you have to change sponsors, if your sponsor gets sick or they're no longer able to sponsor you or whatever, change sponsors. Or if it's just not working and just no communication factor, that change sponsors. So I changed sponsors to Andy. And, man, I'm so ate up with resentment. People, you know, I've got to... My perspective is that people have stabbed me in the back and cost me this job when it was actually my alcoholism that cost me that job. And these people were on my amends list to start out with that I never made. I'd postponed them and never made amends to them. My sponsor that I have today says, "Jim," he says, "these people are on the amends list to start out with. Why don't you try making amends to them and see what happens?" So I did. It was a very humbling experience, not to say that I'm humble, but it was a humbling experience, and I didn't want to do it, but I did it because I wanted to get better. I really did want to get better. And so I went to those people and I made amends to them, and it was just like you could take a piece of paper up, wad it in the trash, and throw it away. Those resentments were gone. And I'll say something else about resentments. There was a guy. I didn't like him. There was a girl I wanted to date. Asked her out. She stood me up and went out with this guy I didn't like. And there were several things that happened. I didn't like this guy. and just ate up with resentment. But there's a on page the bottom of 66 and top of 67, it talks about, you know, if there's somebody you resent, you try to treat them like a sick person. I'm going to say something about that right now, too, before I get sidetracked. I don't know if they're sick or not, but Jim is. Jim is the sick one. Whether they're sick or not is another story. So what I do is go on. There's a prayer there. It says, we ask God how we can be of service to these people. And that's what I did to this guy. I tried to be of service to this guy. And you know what? And that guy friends. Things have totally changed. And that's happened numerous times where I don't like somebody, but I'm of service to them, and something changed. God changes my attitude towards that person. So, you know, it's an ongoing process. I continued working in service work. And finally, after so many years, I became GSR, which is Group Service Representative, not Grand Supreme Ruler. Yeah, no kidding, darn. If you think you're a Grand Supreme Ruler, you're in for a rude awakening. I'm going to tell you that right now. That group is probably not going to buy that, you know. And so I became the GSR, and eventually I became a District Committee Member, DCM. And eventually I quit doing all of the roundup committees. I decided to dedicate my time to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're probably wrongly. I don't regret that mistake. I enjoy going to roundups, and now I don't got to work. But anyway, I had a lot of fun doing the roundups. I mean, they were a great experience. So I got to be DCM. And I also became treasurer of the district, and my DCM, when I was treasurer, she would invite me down to area assembly, and I've been going to area assembly anyway for years. Bob took me to area assembly. I've been going to area assembly almost 25 years now. Probably have been going 25 years now. And then not necessarily because I wanted to go. Area Assembly, back in those days, Area Assembly was something else. People still smoked at Area Assembly. There was a smoking war going on at Area Assembly. And you walk into the room. This is a high ceiling compared to the room. It was about half this high, and I kid you not, there was a cloud of smoke hanging down to here. You know, it almost killed you. If you was a smoker, it would almost kill you, you know? And so I went on through the step service structure, and I got to be registrar, which is me and another person who is now our delegate ran for area treasurer, and it went to the hat, and she won, and I became registrar. And I'm going somewhere with this story, believe it or not. They had a database, and I worked in the computer field, but I'm not a database expert, but I redid the database. And what happened was, is I changed it so it really worked effectively, and people got to know me. And I wasn't playing politics, but I did a really good job. And what happened was, is the next position, I was going to run for something, but I wasn't going to run for the alternate delegate or delegate. I didn't think I was qualified. And but there was a runoff between, actually, the position for alternate delegate went to the hat, and a guy who had been, I guess, my mentor in service, Craig, he was Craig Miller, he got alternate delegate. And I said, well, they just left that position open. I'm as qualified as anybody else here. So I put my name in as alternate delegate. And you know what? I got it. To everybody's surprise, Jim got alternate delegate. You know? And I remember coming back and telling some people, you know, they said, what position did you get? I said, alternate delegate. I said, alternate delegate. You got alternate delegate? I said, yes, I did. And so a year later, something happened in Craig's personal life, and he had to step down. And I became delegate. And then the next time, I got elected delegate. And so I've gone to three real service companies. which is another, you're talking about, I was telling Tim, there's a pamphlet called Many Paths to Spirituality. And there's a paragraph in there that's talking about a Jewish guy who his sponsor made him say the Lord's Prayer. And, you know, there used to be an old adage, you know, if God runs you out of AA, alcohol will run you back. And his sponsors told him something similar regarding the Lord's Prayer. But when it got to the floor of the assembly, we discussed, debated, edited, rewrote that thing, no telling how many times, for 8 hours. One discussion for 8 hours. And now you probably don't want to do that. I mean, normal person don't think we want to do that. But what I found in life is life can be very contentious and you're going to have to face a lot of conflicts. And AA is a perfect place to learn how to deal with those kind of conflicts. And the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful place to start. So I encourage you to do that. And besides that, Alcoholics Anonymous needs good leadership. I don't know how much time I've got left here, but you know, that's the bottom line. We are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do we care about Alcoholics Anonymous? Do we care enough about Alcoholics Anonymous to sacrifice the time and the effort needed to serve Alcoholics Anonymous? But you know what? It ain't happening. That group that I went to, you can't even get them hardly go to a treatment center. You know, you got 350 members, and you might get two or three people to go to a treatment center out of it. That's a shame. And it's just not that group. I'm talking more or less just about AA as a whole that that has happened. It's just it's a multitude of apathy out there. You know, and I would say it starts with sponsorship. To some extent, I think it does. But I'm a sponsor. And you cannot make somebody do what they want to do. You just cannot do it. But you know what? There are young people coming into AA. Maybe they don't know better. Start trying to get them in the service. I do think we need to get some old people. I think there's an attitude. I'm getting on a soapbox, kind of. There are people in AA that AA hadn't exactly gone the way they wanted to go. AA is changing. You know, there's people in AA, in the rooms of AA, that have problems other than alcohol. And, you know, we discuss stuff in AA that maybe they shouldn't be discussing in AA. But all of a sudden, you got old timers going and say, well, I don't like the way this is going anymore, and I'm not going back to that meeting anymore. And they quit coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what? We need those people. We need the old timers just as much as we need the newcomers. Because who's going to guide the newcomers? Who's going to be the mentor of the newcomers? Who's going to stand up for the newcomers and have the courage to say something to them when they get off the track? Because you see, what I found is love is... My father does not have a problem with disciplining me because he loved me. Unconditional love. And this brother that I had, he got sober 2 years longer than I did, but he ain't been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting since I got sober. My mother dies, and me and my father are having a conversation about, I'm concerned about my brother not going to AA meetings. And my father says this, maybe he's a lot sicker than you are, or maybe you're a lot sicker than he is. He wasn't trying to be mean. That's just what a father will tell you the truth. You know? Because they love you. And in AA, we will tell you the truth because we love you. Now, it might hurt your feelings. It really may hurt your feelings. So we need all these people to come to AA. We need all the messages they carry. We need the messages that the young people carry. We need the messages that the old people carry to keep us on. We need that, whether we listen to them or whether we like what they're saying or not. We need it. Because this is a blend of society. I'm about done. Thank you guys very much for asking me to be here. And I'll probably put this on my list to come back again. Thank you very much.